Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 284, To the City, with Alexander Christie Miller. Today we have an interview with a British journalist who was the Turkish correspondent for the Times newspaper between 2010 and 2017. He's written a book called To the City, about the people who live along the Theodosian walls in Istanbul today. Normally I don't touch on the modern world in this podcast, but this book seemed ideal for those of you who have visited Istanbul or plan to and want to know more about the people who live there now. Alexander Christie Miller spoke to dozens of people who live in the vicinity of the walls and tells their stories. Most of them have seen their lives transformed by the changes which have taken place in Turkey in the past 50 years. He also recounts the story of the 1453 siege of the city by Mehmet and sees how that event is remembered and used by today's political leaders. The book is a wonderful read. It really taught me far more about life in Turkey than any amount of news articles or Google searches can, and I would thoroughly recommend it to any of you who want to know more, particularly to those of you who've been to see the Byzantine ruins and are curious about how they are viewed by the locals, the state of preservation, and the intense feelings that the past can provoke. Alexander Christie Miller is from Wiltshire in the UK, studied in Dublin, and was then in Istanbul for 7 years. He was the Times Turkish correspondent during that period, and his writing has also appeared in Newsweek, The Atlantic, Der Spiegel, and The White Review, amongst other publications. To the City is available now from William Collins Books, and as many of you know, to the city is a Greek phrase, istin poli, which gave us the modern word Istanbul. Alexander Christie Miller, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
Not at all. It's really good to speak to you. I so enjoyed the book. So let's start at the beginning. You were sent to be the Times newspaper's Turkish correspondent back in 2010. How much did you know about Turkey before you went, and what was your first impression of the country?
Well, in fact, I wasn't sent to be the Times correspondent. I decided to go out there. I was working as a researcher on the Times foreign desk, and I knew I wanted to get into foreign correspondence. And I was working on a local newspaper at the same time. And I got into the car at work one day, and I put on the radio. And you know when you hear you turn on midway through a radio show, and you hear. So then talking about something, but the vital information of where this place is wasn't there. So I was listening to this show, and they were describing the music and the nightlife and the food and everything in this particular neighborhood. And then finally at the end, they repeated that it was Istanbul they were talking about. And I thought, hey, maybe I could go there. And that sort of set the idea in my mind. And then when I talked to the Times, they said their correspondent was leaving. So they said I could pitch stories to them. If I went there. So I sort of slightly went there on a slight hope that they might give me work. But it ended up, going very well. And to go back to your question, I knew before I came to Turkey, I knew very little about it. You know, I did a lot of sort of fevered reading and talking to other journalists and that sort of thing and analysts before I went out there. But it was a completely new move for me. It was a fascinating place to arrive to. It was, 2010 was this time in Turkey when it was, politically really there were some tremendous changes going on, and there was a lot going on internationally. You had the Syrian uprising began fairly shortly after I arrived. Endless elections, sort of an election almost every year. So there was a lot to write about and a lot to learn.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons I enjoyed the book so much, because sometimes when someone's very immersed in a place or a topic, they forget what they don't know, or what they didn't know before they started. And so you explain things very well as from the perspective that most listeners will come to it, not knowing that much. So can you tell the listeners what your job was like as a foreign correspondent? What were you expected to do with your days? How much did they expect you to know what people were thinking on the street?
So it was very much work was, I think you should say, quite seasonal, in the sense that if there was a lot going on in the country at any one time, you might be expected to write a story every day. But then there might be a couple of months where there's not a huge amount going on, of a level that would interest, a newspaper's foreign desk. And so then, you spend your time working out things to write about and sending them ideas, trying to get them interested, and then trying to convince them that a certain topic is of a level of importance that would make an international newspaper. I wasn't their employee, so I was able to write for other people too. So I was writing for a few other publications, and I think initially, you work out what's going on from talking to analysts, following the Turkish press, and talking to colleagues and that sort of thing. And then, as time went on and my sort of language skills improved, then I would, as time goes on, you get more and more sort of au fait with the general political situation. But I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, Turkey's such a complicated country. I mean, I think any country is complicated. It's a sort of a facile thing to say in a way. But the better I got to know the country, the more uncomfortable I became with the kind of tone of authority that you're expected to take as a foreign correspondent. Because, I often thought about the fact that if I was writing about England, I would be quite hesitant to make the same kind of pronouncements, I was being called on to make about Turkey and the same kind of sweeping analysis of political things. I would be terrified to do that in England. And I kind of thought it's only really a certain level of ignorance and distance that gives me the confidence to do that of another country. And so when so writing the book was really a kind of a way to try and change that relationship slightly, and to try and write in a more ambivalent way, and to meet ordinary people who were interesting but possibly not the kind of people who you would typically have in the news, and sort of tell Turkey's story through their stories, really. So yeah.
Which you do a wonderful job of. I mean, the book is filled with really fascinating glimpses into people's lives. How easy is it to get to know local people? Because many of them tell you very personal details and life stories. And how hard was that to gain people's trust, or are people quite willing to talk to you?
So I spoke to a lot of people, and very many of them, didn't end up in the book. It's partly the people who I wrote about were people who I built a good rapport with, and also on a basic level, I chose to write about people who I felt sure were being honest with me, who I felt like weren't trying to manipulate me, which is very often when someone's speaking to a journalist or a writer, that they've got some political agenda and they're trying to push that, or They want you to believe something. And you know, people are generally, you know, most people are generally pretty open when you're when you are writing, you know, when you want to ask them about their lives. And when you particularly, one thing which made the process easier was the fact that I could go in and say, look, I'm writing a book about the city walls, rather than I'm writing a, you know, a sort of sensitive political, you know, a sensitive political subject. There are a lot of things I could have gone in with which would have probably scared people off. You know, it definitely varies from between different sections of society. So, for example, the sort of very conservative Islamic sections of society can sometimes be more closed in these sort of small communities. There were a couple of communities I went to which were just very, very closed. And, you know, I went and spoke to someone and you could see their agenda was, why is this guy here? He probably has some ulterior motive. And I'm just going to answer his questions and get rid of him as quickly as possible. Interestingly, it was also the same with the, you know, the Rum community, the Greek, you know, I recount in the book how I met the priest from the monastery at Balıklı, which is, you know, by Silivrikapı. And you know, he was very much like, no, I can't talk to you. And I think it, among those communities, there's sometimes a reticence because they sort of they're quite vulnerable and they feel like talking to an outsider could bring unwanted attention on themselves. But no, there was no shortage of people who were happy to talk about their lives. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting, and you just get a really nice cross section of people in different circumstances with who've experienced the great change that's gone on in the city across the last, you know, 50, 70 years. The Byzantine land walls provide the kind of framing device for the book. Most of the people you talk to that you record in the book lived or worked in the vicinity of the walls. Why did you cho choose to focus on that area? For context, Istanbul is now a mega city. Some listeners may not be aware that the majority of people don't live anywhere near the walls or even on the same continent as the walls. So it wasn't necessarily an obvious choice as it might seem to us, as people interested in Byzantine history. So when did you first discover the walls, and why did they strike you as an interesting part of the city?
So I first, you know, I first walked along the walls, I think in 2012 or something. And then I came back there to report on a story a few years later. And you know, from when I first saw them, you know, they just struck me as this sort of extraordinary piece of urban geography, that encapsulate something which I'd observed about Istanbul, which is it's this place where you have this extraordinary rich history, which stretches back for millennia, and you can still see it there in the streets. It's there, it's often very neglected, and all around you there's also this sort of massive change going on, and this you know, it is this huge mega city, which is just steaming ahead. And I sort of wondered how is it that this heritage is surviving and it has endured through all this time when, you know, this city has seen these massive changes, you know, not only now but also in the past. It just seemed very interesting to me that you know, that you have places somewhere like the walls at all, when you think that most other European cities or most cities around the world have, you know, their city walls are gone, or either that, or they're very restored, or so it was really that drew me to them. And initially I thought that I would write an essay about them or something like that, write a sort of long article. And then the more I thought about it, and the more I started interviewing, I was like, no, you know, I could do a portrait of Turkey through this place, because you have all these different kinds of communities living there. And it just seemed like such a rich sort of scene that I thought, no, you know, this could be a book. And And the other way to answer your question really is that if there's a theme underlying the book, it's a theme of change and the sort of fear of change, the destruction that change brings, the sort of fear of catastrophic change. And obviously that's something which is thematically absolutely tied in with the walls and their construction and their history, because they were built as this as a way of obviously saving the city from disaster at a time when your city being captured and sacked meant the end of the world, in a way. And then the story of their capture by Mehmet is another sort of episode of that. And that's something that I feel like resonates in the present day in a sort of thematic way, now that we're also living through this period of immense and potentially catastrophic change. So I wanted to sort of tie those two things together. The walls, were the perfect device for that, really.
Yeah, absolutely. The book is obviously dealing with people's everyday lives. It's not about Byzantine history specifically. So what did people talk about the walls at all in your conversations? Obviously, some of these people live in neighborhoods, near the wall, but they're not looking at the walls. Some people really did live right up next to them. Were they just another part of the life, like another house, another road? Or did people refer to them as not literally Byzantine, but oh, those walls, those Roman walls, did the walls as a historical object come up at all in conversation or not really?
No, they did. I mean, most of the people I spoke to had a sense that they were lucky to live in this historic area with this, great history attached to it, and that, they lived in a special place. It depends really on which section of the walls you go to, because there are many areas of it which are very wild and lawless. Like, as probably some of your listeners will probably know, the land walls of Istanbul are it's about 200 feet from the inside of the inner wall to the outside of the moat. So almost calling it a wall is misleading, because it's this huge sort of section in the city, in its environment, and often it's quite kind of lawless, and no one is really looking after it. So people would sometimes refer to it as this place of crime and this sort of problem next to them, because it wasn't part of their neighborhood. It wasn't controlled by anyone. It was a place where criminals could go and where all that sort of thing. So you sometimes heard it discussed, as a problematic thing. But then also, I talked to people who remembered as kids going and exploring around there, and how much fun they had, as kids going around in big groups and exploring in the Animas dungeon and that sort of thing. And so clearly it's very kind of, several of the people I spoke to, it was clearly something that had kind of inspired them and made a huge imprint on their childhood. One of the characters in the book had trained as a restoration architect, really as a result of having grown up around there and seeing these crumbling buildings around him. Another character in the book, I don't know if I mentioned it in the end in the actual text, but he had, when he'd been at school, he'd done his own project to imagine the restoration of the walls, in which he'd wanted to create a walkway that would go across the glass walkway, so that you could walk along the top of them, the whole way along. So I think it's definitely people feel a connection to them. I mean, maybe we could talk more about, their meaning in broader Turkish society. But I think it's impossible for anyone to live near them and not have a sort of, a strong sense of place,
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I mean, there's no particular reason it should, but does Byzantine history come up in everyday conversation? Because this is a question listeners ask. Or does it seem like Roman ruins seem to us in England? Like, why would that come up in conversation unless you're specifically talking about the Romans?
It's funny. I mean, obviously, it's short answer is no, it doesn't come up hugely often in everyday conversation. But actually, I'd never thought about it before. But the comparison between Britain, Roman history in Britain is quite a good one, because I think in Britain we also had a sense that Roman ruins are somehow foreign. The Romans came here and then they left, and then that it's not quite, it's our heritage, but it's not, but it's somehow also slightly foreign. And in Turkey it's the same, but that foreignness is a far more charged issue, because the Turkish Republic is 100 years old, and when Turkey was created, at the after the First World War, there had been this effort by the victorious Allies after, the Ottoman Empire was defeated in World War One, and the Allies had tried to impose this treaty that would effectively have dismembered Anatolia, and parts would have gone to the Greeks. There would be parts would have gone to different countries, and this really helped create in the Turkish psyche this fear of dismemberment and this fear of foreign powers coming in and taking their land away from them. And that had also been preceded by the Balkan Wars, and really a sort of nearly a century of warfare in which the Ottoman Empire had slowly collapsed, really as a result of its Christian constituents deciding they wanted their own states, and the sort of the ideology of nationalism taking hold. And so there's a very deep fear among a lot of people in Turkey that by drawing attention to the non-Muslim heritage in Istanbul and Anatolia, there's an agenda of they worry that basically these people might come and want to take stuff back. I think it's possibly not quite as intense now as it used to be, but it's very much still there. And there's a sort of, obviously there are a lot of people who are fascinated by and interested in the Byzantine history, and also feel a sense of continuity between, themselves as residents of Istanbul and the past residents, and like this kind of multicultural idea. But there's also on the nationalist side, there's a lot of kind of hostility, I'd say, to the Byzantine past to some degree.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things I found most interesting about the book, because listeners who come on the tours with me with the nicest of intentions, I think, sort of probe as to why the Byzantine ruins aren't presented like they might be in a Western European city, as sort of beautifully preserved bits of the past. And so I think they understand there's a sense of tension with modern Turkey and its relationship with the past. But you bring that out in the book really well, and in a way that really helped me understand things, because I think particularly as a British person, obviously Western nationalism is sort of what set the world on this path to sort of nation states. And I think in particularly in Britain, where the geography makes it very clear where Britain is and isn't, we just take nationalism for granted. Whereas somewhere like Turkey, it's a much newer idea. And you sort of talk about, the conflicts with Greek people, with Armenian people, even with Kurdish and Alevi minorities and things, not to get too much into the politics of it, but just that what it means to be Turkish feels much more fragile and much more contested. Was that your sense of it as a as an outsider?
Yeah, I mean, you could say fragile, or you could say very strong.
Yeah.
It's like in a way, maybe we're saying the same thing. But it's yeah, there's this, nationalism in Turkey is an incredibly, it really is the glue that holds the country together. Nationalism and Islam, and that is partly as a result of the fact that it was consolidated as a nation state very recently. And also, when you talk to Turkish people and ask them about where they come from, very often if they go back, a lot of Turkeys, a lot of Turks can trace their roots back to the Balkans or back to other places. What was I going to say? Hold on. So the other interesting thing about Turkey is that it's a post-imperial country. So Turks have this sense of themselves as the heirs to this great empire, the Ottoman Empire, and a lot of Turks feel that way. And so that creates kind of a sort of certain nationalist sentiment. But it's also in so it has some characteristics of a post-colonial society as well, in that Atatürk, who founded the country and who was this great hero, and that he kicked out the European powers and he kicked out Greece. He, having won that, he then set the country on this sort of radicalized Western course. And so, a lot of Turks who didn't like that have kind of grown up with this slight resentment of feeling that they've had a foreign culture imposed on them. And so between those two things, that sort of post-colonial mentality and that post-imperial mentality, it makes for a very kind of quite a strident form of nationalism sometimes. I think people live with a sense of threat that, particularly in a country like Britain, I think we find hard to appreciate because, we haven't faced it in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't talk more about modern politics because I try to avoid it, but that's one of the most interesting parts of the book. And I think, as I said before, it will really appeal to people who aren't very knowledgeable about modern Turkish politics because you explain it very well. And so I really enjoyed that. So on a lighter note, when I was about to go to Istanbul for the first time, I was looking at the land walls on Google Street View, and I'm sure we've all had this experience where you're looking at a street, say in your own city, and a bus is following your view down the road, because the cameras who took it, so the bus keeps obscuring the shops or the parking signs you're trying to see. So I went to one end of the walls, and every time I moved, more dogs appeared, alarmingly, dozens and dozens of dogs. And I thought, what's going on here? And thankfully, your book answered that question. So visitors to Istanbul immediately noticed the street dogs and cats. But you got to know some of the street dogs very well. And can you tell the listeners about that and also about the street dog culture in Istanbul?
I very much wanted to include. I like writing about animals and the relationship between humans and animals, and it, for no particularly logical reason, I decided to start. I was walking on the walls and I found this animal shelter there, and I just thought, okay, I'm going to volunteer here for a bit, it's one of the things that strikes you when you live in Istanbul is that there is this quite extraordinary culture of street animals, where you have dogs and cats who live on the street, and are ostensibly strays, but they're sort of looked after by the community in general. And I remember particularly, I mean, it's important to say that this isn't universal throughout the city. This tends to be in certain neighborhoods in probably more affluent areas, or that there are large parts of the city where, the stray dogs are miserable, council will gather them up and leave them on the outskirts of the city and that sort of thing. But it's very clear in a lot of the city that there's this culture where people look after these street animals. And one thing that really struck me was I was visiting a friend, and there was a dog that had been hit by a car or something. And a lot of local people in the area just clubbed together and paid for its vet fees to go and have its leg fixed. People feed them, people look after them. Same with cats, if anything more so with cats. And When I looked into this, I saw that this is something which has gone on for centuries, and that European visitors who were visiting the Ottoman Istanbul, 400 years ago, were noting the same thing and remarking on the same thing. And so, I wanted to write about that, A, as a way of talking about, the placing the story within the context of our relationship with nature and what it means to we have a human world and we have a natural world. And what struck me as so interesting about the Ottoman attitude is that at that time Europeans really thought nothing of animals. They were like objects you could use. Whereas the Ottomans, they didn't they didn't think they were people, but they in some way they regarded them as legitimate denizens of the city. And there were organizations which raised money to give meat to stray dogs, in Ottoman times. They cared for them in the same way that they would care for these guilds of beggars who lived in Ottoman Istanbul and lived on the streets and were the sort of focus of charity. And that tradition has changed, but it still sort of in some form survives. And it's very interesting the way it now interacts with our more modern view of animal welfare, where a lot of people would say, look at these dogs, they're kind of miserable. They're on the streets, they're not very healthy, they look mangy, they sometimes bite people. They shouldn't be here. To which, a lot of Turkish people would answer, well, what are you going to do? You're going to spay them out of existence. Like, that's not fair. So it raises this very interesting and difficult moral question about how what you do, how our relationship with animals. It's, I actually own an Istanbul street dog now. I brought one back for it from Eng back to England.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And you volunteered for a while in a shelter right by the walls, which
Yes, exactly. Right under the walls. And it was a wonderful place to be because it was really like, it was very picturesque. I mean, it stank, and I describe in the book, all the dog shit everywhere, and it was quite unpleasant in some ways. But it was also it felt like quite a special thing to do because it just took me so completely out of my ordinary life in Istanbul. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's another lovely part of the book. Well, let's wrap up, and obviously I encourage people to go and buy the book and discover more. But what other things did you love about Turkey? What things did you really enjoy? One you could mention, which I particularly enjoyed hearing, was the ornate and specific expressions in social interactions.
So it's interesting. At one point in the book, actually, when I'm talking about the dogs, I refer there's this incredibly. I would recommend anyone to read the letters of Ogier. I don't know. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but he was a Flemish diplomat in Istanbul during the time of Suleiman the Magnificent. So when the empire was absolutely at its height, Ogier Gisselin de Busbecq, I'm probably completely mispronouncing that, but and he wrote four Turkish letters in Latin of his time when he was on an embassy, I think from the Holy Roman Emperor, in Istanbul, and he was kind of kept there as a hostage in sort of a friendly way for quite a long time. And he writes these incredibly funny, vivid letters about his time. And one of the most memorable things to me was when he writes about how he's seeing the robes that the Ottomans wear, and that they wear these long robes, and he's admiring how good they look in them and how they make them look taller. And then he sort of compares it with his own clothes, which he says are very kind of tight and ill-fitting. I think he says something like, discloses parts of the body which would be better not disclosed, or something like that. And it's very interesting because, in obviously, in later years, when the Ottomans became the sick man of Europe, Europeans would come and very much look down on the world around them and on the Ottoman world. But this was from a time when he was going there, and he sort of couldn't help but feel like he was, entering into a society which was more successful, better functioning, that sort of thing. I compare that in the book to my feeling of going back to England. And in Turkish, you have a huge array of phrases for different social situations. You say geçmiş olsun if something's gone wrong. You say başınız sağ olsun if someone's died. You say there are all kinds of different things, and English doesn't have nearly as many of those. And I found like that when I moved back to England, I kind of missed them. I sort of particularly the one geçmiş olsun, which literally means may it be in the past, or may it be done with. If someone's been sick or if something bad has happened to them, any kind of bad things happen to them, that's what you say. There wasn't really in English, you'd say, what, sorry, get well soon. There's somehow they all seem slightly more awkward in comparison. So I love that side of it. It's a country where there's a huge amount of social tension, and there's a huge amount of polarization, but there's also, I found, a sense that these small social niceties kind of have an importance to them. That was one thing that I liked. One of many things. I love the food. I love, it's a wonderful, wonderful country.
Fantastic. Well, To the City, Life and Death Along the Ancient Walls of Istanbul is available now, and I encourage everyone to go out and get it. Alexander Christie Miller, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
After we wrapped up, Alexander said he wanted to actually add something about why it's so difficult for the municipality to actually preserve the entire section of the land walls.
So it always seemed interesting to me that that somewhere like the walls was in a state of neglect, whereas obviously you have these former churches, which are now mosques, which are all in a state of which are cared for very intensely. And I think that there's a big difference between the religious buildings in that the Byzantines left behind are kind of appropriatable property. And they can be taken, they can be repurposed, they can be used and given another life. Whereas the secular Byzantine buildings, especially, and I think especially if they're in some way a symbol of or a reminder of Byzantine power, are more difficult to kind of, they're harder to ideologically appropriate into the sort of, the new sort of state, I guess. And it's interesting that one of the buildings that's recently been restored, which is the palace of the, I'm sorry, I'm going to do a mispronunciation here, but the palace of the Porphyrogenitos, and that stood derelict for a long time, and now it's been restored. But inside it there are actually displays of Ottoman ceramics and calligraphy. So it's like there's very much like the use of there's a big issue over the restoration and the use of buildings, and particularly the current government. That was maybe going into this, but the current government has this. We have this view in the West, but particularly that you restore a monument as it was at a certain point in time, and then you open it for people to look at, and that's what its function is. But there's more of a mentality in particularly among the current government in Turkey, that these buildings should have a purpose and they should have a function. They it's legitimate for them to take it, to completely remake them, and to use them for some new purpose. And so very often that's what you see. I don't know, maybe I don't know where I was going with that anyway.
No, that's really interesting, though. I mean, that's sort of what I was getting at, that listeners bring with them the assumption of how historical items should be displayed, And actually, other cultures can have a different attitude and a different perspective.
Exactly. And the other important point, specifically in the case of the walls, is that they're huge. They stretch 4 miles. Restoring them is a massive job, and also they're not the Hagia Sophia. They're not quite as easily monetizable as some of the other big attractions in Istanbul. So they would be tremendously expensive to restore. They're probably not going to make that much money as tourist attractions. And then also, the work of restoring them requires a sort of a continuous political will on the part of the city's authorities, which has never really been there. Partly, that there have been restoration attempts and there have been bits done here and there. But then the municipality, which is, the municipal administration, which is doing the work, loses power, and then the next one comes along and has different priorities. You have overlapping jurisdictions in terms of who's in charge of different bits. So there's a number of quite practical considerations which kind of conspire to make it unlikely that they're going to be fully restored, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. To the City is also available on Audible. So if you'd like to listen to the book, you can find it there. And if you'd like to listen for free, then sign up at audibletrial.com/Byzantium, where you'll get 1 month's free membership. And you can keep the book if you decide not to continue with Audible service. Or like me, you can get sucked into listening to book after book after old radio show after all the amazing things in Audible's collection.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.